radical change I had ever run in 7 days. It was too much. On the last day, I developed patellofemoral pain, aka runner's knee, which sidelined me for the next 10 days. I did everything to rehab it, but on race day, after spending a lot of time in second and third place, the knee hurt so much that I couldn't run downhill. I dropped out at mile 75. In 2009, I was in good shape and in a good frame of mind. Jenny was running too, and Dusty was crewing for me. The race doesn't allow pacers. What I hadn't counted on was the rain and worse, the fog. I ran well early and was in the top 10 until I got lost. I found my way back and moved into the top 3, and that's when nausea and cramps hit. The last 20 miles I could hardly keep anything down. This time, though, I was determined to finish. And I did. In a little over 26 hours. 18th place. When the announcer handed me the microphone after I crossed the finish line, the first thing I said was, "I am proud to be in the UTMB finisher family." Dusty said, "I'm proud of you, jerker." The next day, Dusty crewed, and we both cheered for Jenny as she finished in her first try. I finished the race I had vowed to finish. Jenny and I were having fun together. Things were working out. Then, on September 25th, Scott McCoubrey called to tell me Dave Terry had killed himself. He had recently gone through foot surgery and was not able to get back to running. None of us knew it, but he battled depression much of his life. He was 50 years old. After attending Dave's funeral and burial earlier in the afternoon, a group of his friends, mostly runners, gathered at Scott's cabin at Crystal Mountain near the White River 50-mile race course in Washington. Dave had run in the race more than 10 times. We cried and asked one another if Dave had ever let on how sad he was. We laughed, too, and talked about how kind he was, how he brought a richness to all of our lives. Dusty was there. He gave me shit, as usual, even at a memorial service, but this time, it had an edge to it. He kept saying things like, "You want to try a real race? Try beating my marathon time." And, "Don't forget who has the faster 100K time." It was during this period that he made sure I knew how many homes he owned, too, and mocked me for how much money I lost in my divorce. And after the gathering, he stopped calling me. When he texted, he would write, "You fucking loser." I knew that another friend of Dusty's killed himself just a few months earlier. I figured that it was grief talking, so I tried to joke it away. A month later, I decided to get back on the path in Cleveland. A 24-hour race was being held there. It took place on a concrete loop 1 mile around. I called Dusty to ask him to come with Jenny and me, but he didn't answer, so I left messages. He didn't return my calls, so Jenny called him. He declined the invitation. "I'm tired of being Jerker's bitch," he said. Though Dusty had always been the better and much better known athlete in high school, he didn't make a life as a professional athlete. When Jenny told me what he said, I began to rewind the last year or so. Born to Run had been published and become a phenomenon, and phenomenally successful. I had been featured in more magazine articles. Meanwhile, Dusty and I hadn't talked as much as usual. Had he been pulling away? Chafing at my increased notoriety? Me? The jerker? The less innately talented of boyhood friends? One of the things I appreciated about running was how it strengthened and deepened friendships. Could it have cost me my most important, closest friend? I did the only thing I could. I gave him space. I didn't call or write, didn't ask him to help me at races. I didn't visit, and I missed him. I arrived in Cleveland on a cold, wet October weekend, and I dropped out of the race at 65 miles. My legs were still tired from the UTMB. My heart and soul were weary from just about everything else. 5 months later, at the nursing home, I called Jenny, and she flew to Minnesota. "Mom," I said, "this is Jenny, the girl I've talked about so much." My mother didn't say anything. She couldn't, but I knew she understood. Jenny and I spent my mother's last 3 days with her. While I took care of my mom, Jenny was taking care of me, making sure I got food, sleep, and fresh air from time to time. We played my mother's favorite Celine Dion CDs and sang along. I slept in the chair by my mom, and Jenny slept in a makeshift apartment in the nursing home basement. The first night, I saw how frightened my mother was. She had always told people not to worry. "I'm tough," she always said to anyone who asked if she was feeling all right. "I'm tough." But before she slipped into unconsciousness, it was as if she was reminding herself that she could do this one last thing, that she could move through this, that she could do the thing we all fear. She died on March 22nd. Those last hours I didn't stop stroking her hair or telling her, "Don't worry, I'm here." I told her that I was a good cook because of her. I told her I ate fresh fruit and vegetables because of her. I told her I ran because of her. I told her I could still picture the little garden on our dead-end road. I could feel the rough wooden spoon, my hands clutching it, hers covering mine. I told her I remembered that, how warm her hands felt. I told her I loved her, and that she would always be with me. I didn't tell her. I was lost. Chapter 20. Secrets of the Dark Wizard. Yosemite Valley, 2010. A quote from Bruce Lee. "Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water." Trees and cliffs swayed in front of me, and I knew that one misstep would send me plunging to earth. My arms were out, my right foot a foot in front of my left, and I was trying to balance on an inch-wide piece of climbing webbing tied to a ponderosa pine in front of me, and 30 feet behind me, an old gnarled oak. For most of my life, a misstep preceded a stumble. Here, it would lead to a fall. Here, balance didn't mean improved performance. It meant success or failure. One step at a time. One step. The ground swayed. My teacher regularly walked over chasms thousands of feet deep. He scaled terminal granite rock faces with no safety equipment. He pioneered the sport of free base climbing. Free solo climbing with a parachute as the only means of protection, and at the moment was trying to figure out a way to dive off a cliff, soar through the air, and land without a parachute. He said it was merely a matter of physics. Because he practiced dark arts, they called him the Dark Wizard. His real name was Dean Potter. Jenny introduced us in January 2010, and he invited us to the small cabin he rented in Yosemite Valley. He called it the Shack. I had heard and read about Dean, how he sought to alter his consciousness through feats of extreme athleticism and challenge. He had read Born to Run and saw me as a kindred spirit. Yosemite was Jenny's favorite place on Earth. I loved the outdoors. It seemed like a perfect place to go after my mother died. Dean's shack was clean and neat. His refrigerator was stocked with chia seeds, young coconuts, and spirulina powder. On his wall hung an old advertisement, yellowed with age, for Eagle Electric. In small print it read, "Perfection is not an accident." I wanted to spend time in the valley grieving, healing from my mother's passing. I also wanted to understand why I ran and to decide whether I wanted to continue. To help me understand, and to help me decide, I would walk on webbing between trees. Slacklining is a discipline that requires extreme focus, yet your body has to remain fluid and relaxed. You must calm the instinctual fear that has allowed humans to survive. It teaches you to let go of your fears and forces you to trust the power of your mind, to trust a power somewhere else. Dean had started me off 4 feet off the ground. Learning took time. When I stepped on the line, it would shake uncontrollably from side to side, making it impossible to balance. It was a challenge in itself to stand up on the line, let alone take a step. Progress was slow. Time after time, the line bucked me off until I realized I was causing the line to shake and learned to calm it with my body and my mind in sync. I considered quitting before. I talked about it once to a non-runner I had met a few years earlier. We were at an aid station on a ridgeline 3,000 feet above Ojai, California, welcoming runners, offering them bananas, filling their water bottles, and telling them they were doing great. It was November 2008, the Rose Valley 33 miler, and I didn't realize it, but I must have been telling the guy about my doubts. The guy had fixed me with an odd glare. "Dude," he said, "you'd better take advantage of what you've accomplished. You're not going to be Scott Jurek forever." There are ultra runners who don't question why they do what they do, but I am not one of them. Why did I run? Is ultramarathoning crazy? Is it hopelessly selfish? Can I have solitude and also love? Is there any value in winning? Competition drives me, but I know that losing myself is the real key to fulfillment. How can I win without ego? Was I too focused on winning? Had I lost the capacity for being in the moment that had, paradoxically, brought me my greatest recognition? Or were my doubts and loss of motivation merely chemical? Countless studies have pinpointed the source of runner's high as being elevated levels of endorphins and endocannabinoids, naturally occurring substances that affect the brain, produced in large amounts by exercise. This might explain the apparently large number of recovering addicts in the ultra-running community. I met a runner named Bill Key when I was in Southern California in 2001 training for the Angeles Crest 100. He had long gray hair and a gray handlebar mustache. He wore cut-off shorts with flames painted on both sides. Running from one pocket to a belt loop was a heavy metal chain holding his wallet. This was the uniform he ran in. He carried 2 48-ounce Gatorade bottles, and when he finished a race, he put them aside and put on his leather jacket with its Team Death insignia, got into his big black Chevy van, and drove toward the horizon. Key told me that he started drinking and doing drugs when he was 18, and he didn't stop till 14 years later, when he decided that life as a drunk and an addict, with its jail time, 3 packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day, and other wonders, wasn't working. He was living in Ojai, California, right next to the foothills of the Topatopa Mountains, and every night, jonesing for a cigarette, he'd hike into those hills. One cold night, he parked his car at the bottom of his driveway and decided to run the quarter mile to his house. Then, on a dare, he ran up a 3-mile hill, 1,700 feet of ascent. Marathons followed. He didn't know what he was doing, bonked often, learned fast. He didn't even know what an ultramarathon was until he read about it in a magazine. He ran his first one in 1999. He's 54 now. He lost a kidney in a motorcycle accident in 1980. He's been suffering from Lyme disease since 2005. But he's been sober and smoke-free since he started running. "Scott," Key told me in 2001, "running is my new drug." Key has plenty of company. The mohawked, tattooed, reptile-toting Ben Hyen didn't become an ultra-running legend until he kicked his addiction to mood-altering drugs and trained his obsessive focus on running long distances. And many of the runners I have encountered in my career have talked about their struggles with marijuana, as well as eating disorders and general difficulty finding peace anywhere but on the trail. Can running become its own addiction? One gruesome study showed that rats love running so much they can actually run themselves to death. When offered food for only one 90-minute period per day, the rats in the control group, without an exercise wheel, soon learned to adapt, taking in all the calories they needed during that meal. Rats with running wheels, however, ran more and more every day while eating less and less. They eventually starved to death. Some of ultra-running's greatest champions seem to have burned out or just given up at a certain point. Cautionary tales abound in the ultra community, passed from runner to runner at pre-race breakfasts and post-race award ceremonies, like the story of Icarus and his doomed wax wings was whispered among ambitious, worried Greeks. My hero, Chuck Jones, ran his last ultra in 1988, when, after watching a UFO hover over Death Valley during the Badwater Ultra Marathon, he suspects it was a hallucination brought on by dehydration, he passed out. "Now I'm a sunset runner," he says. "I work all day in the sun, laying asphalt, then I just want to run, relax, and recover to see what the body can do." The great Ann Trason, who won 14 Western states and almost beat the Tarahumara in a widely publicized Leadville 100 in 1994, the Indians call her Bruja, or the Witch, has suffered numerous injuries, and though she hasn't stopped running, she hasn't entered an ultra for several years. She lamented to a reporter, "I just wish I could go out and run every day. I think I took it for granted. I knew I'd slow down and get older, but I didn't know there'd be a cliff." The summer after he showed me around the San Juan Mountains, in 2007, Kyle Skaggs returned to Silverton to run the Hard Rock 100. He set a new clockwise and overall course record by almost 3 hours. He also set speed records for the Wasatch Front 100, circumnavigating Mount Rainier on the Wonderland Trail and running the Grand Canyon rim to rim. Then, at the age of 24, he quit. He now grows organic vegetables on his farm in New Mexico. He hasn't run a competitive step since 2008. Had I reached my cliff? I had always been careful to rest when I needed to, especially when hurt, conscientious about treating my body right. But was burning out, or apparently happy abstinence, the inevitable price of intensely focused training like mine? Could I succeed without my focus? Had I been lying to myself by thinking I was living a life of balance? Jenny thought we should take a break to process the recent events in a peaceful place. A week after my mother died, we drove the 6 hours to Yosemite. We spent 3 days with Dean. I saw that he was a balance of yin and yang. There's an exquisite sensitivity and softness in his movements when he's walking a line or free soloing a granite wall. He seems to work with rock and sky, as though he's able to sense and surrender to currents of air that are invisible to the rest of us. At the same time, he climbs with ferocity and maintains a crushing training routine. You need that kind of ego strength to overcome fear. Dean was married for 8 years before divorcing in 2010. It was one of the things we bonded over. Another thing we had in common was our age. Like me, Dean was nearing the peak of his physical ability. At 38, he was starting to talk wistfully about the rising generation of whippersnappers with intact joints and the fearlessness of innocence. He called these climbers monkey children, who made everything seem so easy. I liked the way he was handling his transition. He lived in a simple cabin in Yosemite, with his little dog, Whisper. His life was minimal, lit up by solitude and nature. We talked about nutrition and about the deaths of my mother and his father years earlier. He said he was so focused when he was on 20-hour link-up climbs of big walls that he went into a trance and was convinced he heard radio frequencies. We talked about God, the limits of technology, how in order to win, one had to realize that winning didn't matter. I didn't think I could make it to the tree in front of me. I anticipated a fall. One step at a time, Dean said, as I faltered and swayed. Stay present. Connecting with others. If you're an ultra runner and you spend hours and hours alone on a daily basis, training in remote, unpopulated areas, running can be a solitary undertaking. It's ironic, then, that some of the greatest and deepest joys in my running career have come from the people I've met and the things we have shared. You don't have to be an ultra runner to take advantage of the social rewards of running. Try running, at least on some of your routes, with a friend. Join a running club or weekly group run. Enter a 5K or 10K race. Do something for running that doesn't involve running. Working at the finish line or at an aid station or joining trail work parties, all of which I've done, provide great ways for me to participate, to give back to the sport that's given me so much. Running can be a lonely activity. It can also introduce you to people worlds beyond your imagining. Chapter 21. Back to My Roots. Tonto Trail, Grand Canyon, 2010. A quote from Rumi. Let the beauty we love be what we do. Here was another good place to stop. Cold, dark, silent as a deserted cathedral. A velvety snowfall. In my running career, there's been so many of these places. This time, I would submit. Almost 20 years of serious running, more than a decade since my first Western States, a lifetime of sometimes you just do things, and I had done them. And what had it accomplished? It hadn't prevented my marriage from failing. It hadn't warded off injuries. I had done things when I didn't think I could do them anymore. Dusty was angry. Dave Terry had killed himself, and my mother was gone. I could do these things every day the rest of my life, every minute. What would it matter? On this day, my food was almost gone. My headlamp had dimmed and was losing battery life fast. I was at least 50 miles from a phone or a road. It was 2 a.m., cold, and a part of me knew that it might be dangerous to stop. Part of me didn't care. I had been running for 20 hours. Below, a yawning chasm. Above, a black dome smeared with stars. And there, on my right, a flat rock outcropping with a shallow cave. A perfect place to lie down, to hide from the darkness and the cold. I would lie there and wait and rest, and in a few hours, the dome would pale, and tumbleweeds would stir, and the cacti would emerge from the gloom like gentle, friendly sentries, and I would be rested and warm, and then I could run. Then, I could do things. Not a good idea, man. It's too cold. Once you lie down, it's gonna be really hard to get up. If we stop now, we might be stopped forever. How many times had someone urged me on? How many times did someone tell me to get up? To get moving, that even if I didn't think I could go on, he or she knew better. Let's go. Just a few more hours of running before the sun comes up. Another friend, with more sensible, optimistic advice. But I was so tired. My backup light, a single, dim LED bulb, basically a keychain light, was putting me to sleep. I would feel better after lying down. The hard sandstone would feel soft to my fatigued and sore muscles. It was such a perfect spot. I wanted to stop. The plan had been to run free to honor my mother's passing, to recapture the feeling I had on the game trails with Dusty before I started running for belt buckles and corporate sponsors. Dusty and I were barely talking, though. So I asked my 28-year-old buddy Joe if he might want to accompany me on a 90-mile traverse of the Grand Canyon on the Tonto Trail, unsupported. No other human being in modern times had run the trail in one push, carrying his own food and water. For over a decade, I've been inspired by John Anarino's Running Wild and Colin Fletcher's The Man Who Walked Through Time. I had met Joe the year before, and he was fast and hungry for adventure. Best of all, I had a feeling he knew what I was trying to capture. He had traveled to Copper Canyon to race the Tarahumara 2 years earlier. He had won. We each carried 7 energy bars and 30 Cliffshot gels, as well as headlights with emergency backups. A lightweight, water-resistant shell would be our only shelter. I packed 2 bean burritos, some cookies, an almond butter sandwich, and a map. For water, we would drink from streams that were flowing due to the South Rim's melting snow. We had to make sure we avoided the creeks that were contaminated with uranium from turn-of-the-century mines, now dormant. It was first light, 20 degrees. Although the Grand Canyon is known for its scorching temperatures, it was bitter cold. Our first step was straight down, and in the first 4 miles we plunged 3,000 feet, crossing cliff bands, running alongside a narrow trail lined first with ponderosa pine, then oak and sagebrush, and finally cacti. We followed drainage chutes between the rocks that marked geologic time in millions of years. By the time we made it to the Tonto Trail, which follows the broad plateau that parallels the canyon and stands watch 3,000 feet above the mighty Colorado River, our shins were shredded and raw. It had been a while since I was so cut off from civilization, so far away from telephones and email and race forms and travel arrangements. There was just us, and the empty sky, and the rocky ground, and the cactus. The temperature rose swiftly to a warm 85 degrees, reminding us that this place was home to desert creatures. Sometimes I took the lead, other times Joe did. We were never more than a quarter mile apart. Progress was slower than we had expected, as we learned from the hikers, the only people we saw that day, who informed us we were 4 drainages behind our estimated location. We weren't discouraged. We had plenty of water and food, and the abundant beauty made every mile drift by without anticipation. By late afternoon, our shadows had disappeared, and bulging dark clouds had filled the empty sky, bullying one another for position. We heard a low moan, which turned into a shriek. Dust and sand flew from the plateau on 50-mile-per-hour winds, and then the rain started. Drops splattered sideways against the rock. At 45 miles, after running for 16 hours, lightning crashed ahead of us and behind us. There was nowhere to hide on the barren plateau, so the only option was to run. Finally, we climbed down a pebbly drainage to a campground called Indian Gardens, at the intersection of the almost highway-like Bright Angel Trail and the Tonto Trail. We filled our water bottles in a downpour, the winds still shrieking. Thunder boomed and echoed in the canyon. A skinny bank of dirt snaked down to the valley floor, and in the distance, faint lights twinkled from the Phantom Ranch along the banks of the Colorado. Above us, the Bright Angel Trail wound its way 3,500 feet to the South Rim and the Grand Canyon Lodge at almost 7,000 feet above sea level. There was a little unmanned ranger station next to us. It was the one spot on the trail where we could abandon the journey. Joe thought we should. He had some races coming up in the spring. I wasn't done with competition. Joe was also running low on food, and we were only halfway. Just then, he dropped half an energy bar to the ground. From his comfortable seat on a bench, he slowly bent over to pick up the sand-covered chunk. He didn't even bother to brush off the precious calories. Completely out of it, he tossed the bar to the bushes while letting out a helpless sigh. Wouldn't it be better to bail now than to risk it? Even if this storm passed, what if another came along? We both knew that too much water from above could wash us off the plateau into the canyon below, or leave us hypothermic in the dark chill of the night. I make a point to plan, to reduce risk. I measure danger against desire. I told Joe that I thought we had run through the worst. I told him we had both gutted our way through worse difficulties. I said the weather report had said the storm cell was expected to move through. Then I pointed to a circle of stars, the only one I could find, directly above us. We ran for 3 more hours. The rain stopped, The clouds vanished. We didn't talk. My headlight went out around mile 70, and my reserve light failed an hour later. We had spent the last hour and a half in a dry creek bed searching for the now scarcely defined Tonto Trail. I had eaten both of the burritos, countless gels, and several Cliff Bars, but I was hungry and cold. Mostly, I was tired. When I saw the rocky overhang, I measured desire and danger again and came to a conclusion. This would be a good place to stop. Just for half an hour. Just to get a short nap. Joe didn't think so. Obviously, Joe was right. Come on, we just have a few hours before sunup and 5 hours until we finish, he said. It turned out to be 12 hours. There were no aid stations, no crowds, no challengers, no race directors, just the earth and a friend, and the sky and movement. The landscape diminished us. Nature's arena has a way of humbling and energizing us. I had never felt so tiny. I had never felt so big. The sky grew colder and darker, and then I could see my breath. My shadow returned, along with the neighborly cacti, the warming, welcoming sky. Explosions of red, orange, and yellow blasted the canyon walls above us and lit up the great formations across from us. The great chasm opened below. Yesterday melted, and with it, all yesterdays. To consider the future seemed as silly as trying to divine meaning from the melting morning dew. Joe and I would literally claw our way at times on all fours, almost 5,000 feet out of the canyon on the New Hance Trail. Some 30 hours after we entered, we stumbled into a tourist trap, gorged on guacamole and chips, and washed them down with Negro Modelo beers. Joe excused himself to go to the bathroom, where he promptly fell asleep on the toilet. After I pounded on the door and awakened him, we both pushed the seats back in the rental car and slept for an hour and a half. Afterward, we drove to Ian's place in Flagstaff and told him what he had missed. But we didn't know that when we ran along the wide plateau, chasing our shadows, alone, on a giant ledge 3 miles from the ancient river, 3,500 feet below the humanity-packed rim. For those hours on the Tonto Trail, we didn't know anything except the land and the sky and our bodies. I was free from everything except what I was doing at that very moment, floating between what was and what would be as surely as I was suspended between river and rim. Finally, I had remembered what I had found in ultra running. I remembered what I had lost. Epilogue. World 24-Hour Championships 2010. A quote from Jeremy Collins. Sometimes the best journeys aren't necessarily from east to west or from ground to summit, but from heart to head. Between them, we find our voice. We all lose sometimes. We fail to get what we want. Friends and loved ones leave. We make a decision we regret. We try our hardest and come up short. It's not the losing that defines us. It's how we lose. It's what we do afterward. I decided I would make another attempt at a 24-hour race and chase a new American record. So I flew to France for the 2010 IAU World 24-Hour Championships. There were hundreds of other runners, never farther than a few feet away, all circling in this particular event, a 1.4 kilometer, 0.9 mile course of pavement and hard-packed dirt through the village of Brive-la-Gaillarde. The course was shaped like a snake twisting its way through the park, even doubling back on itself with hairpin corners, and on its longest stretch, it passed a street filled with bars and restaurants. There were two tiny rises that added up to 10 feet of elevation change per lap. Barely noticeable to a spectator, the hills would feel, after a few hours running, like constant, painful pinpricks. People, even many ultra-runners, wonder why anyone would run a 24-hour event. The overarching question people ask usually takes the form of one word: why? The more particular question in my case, as articulated on internet message boards and blogs, in magazine articles, and sometimes put to me by my friends and acquaintances, were more pointed. Why now? Do you have something to prove? Are you running away from something? The answers were more complicated. I did want to win again, but I wasn't all that worried about a single year without a major victory, especially in the context of my career. I did want to find that place of egolessness and mindlessness that only the monotony of a 24-hour race can produce, but mostly I wanted to run because of my mother. If she, after decades of losing nearly all her muscle control, in the last hours of a grueling last week could proclaim her toughness, then I could do my best to live up to her example. Much of her life, she couldn't walk. I would run for her. Jenny and I arrived 9 days before the race, and spent 6 of them in a tiny village outside Paris called Boutigny-sur-Essonne, 5 hours and 2 train rides from the race site. I wanted to recreate at least the spirit of my Western States preparations. I wanted the quiet and the solitude. We stayed in a garden apartment owned by some friends of ours. It had been a mill hundreds of years ago, built above a small river, next to multicolored vegetable gardens and a field of rapeseed, yellow as egg yolks. The streets were narrow and cobblestoned, and the night sky was brilliant with stars. Jenny spent most of those days climbing in nearby Fontainebleau, and I loped through the outlying fields of more rapeseed, of wildflowers, of young wheat and rye. Together, we slacklined in an area of Fontainebleau called the Sea of Sand. Except for the tiny travel blender I had packed, and our computers, it was a quiet, simple existence. We would wake and have smoothies every morning with fresh whole grain bread from the small bakery in town, then run and climb and take walks together, and catch up on email in the evening before we went to bed and talk about food and music and life and death and meaning and love. We fell asleep to the rushing of the stream and the cool spring breeze wafting through the window. Most mornings, I would run 6 miles through the woods to the nearest village with a natural food store. I prepared simple meals from the local produce and traditional French herbs. I love how the French value good food and the basic necessities of life. The rustic cobblestone village felt like stepping back in time before we overcomplicated our lives. By the time of the race, on May 13th, I had done my best to empty my mind of everything but my goal, to run as hard as I could for 24 hours. I wanted to push my body as far as it could go, without going too far. Once again, I was seeking that elusive edge. The city buses carried signs blaring details of the event. Teams brought acupuncturists, physicians, and athletic trainers. The patrons at the bars and cafes in the long stretch of the course cheered whenever we passed. I was part of the U.S. men's team, made up of seasoned veterans and solid newcomers. We would be competing against the Japanese, South Koreans, Italians, and runners from 20 other countries in Europe, Asia, North and South America, and Australia. The Japanese were the perennial favorites, although this year many of their top runners would be competing in a 48-hour race the following weekend, so a lot of unknown runners were ready to shake things up. A Spaniard I didn't know jumped out in front, and I, along with 228 others, followed. After just a few miles, the Spaniard had dropped back, and the lead was changing hands every lap around the twisted course. With that many runners on that short of a course, misunderstandings are almost inevitable. But this international crowd kept the peace. Since I didn't know anything but English, whenever I passed someone, I would just shout the international Nordic skiing words for passing. Hup! Hup! I started out too fast. I could tell because the timing chip triggered the clock, and my splits were just over a 6-minute mile pace. But after a few miles, I fell into an easy rhythm of 7-minute miles. Lee Dong-mun of South Korea lapped me around the marathon mark, along with Shingo Inoue of Japan, a few laps later. I let them go. I wasn't racing against them. I was racing with myself and against the ticking clock. The next 6 hours, my life was stripped to its essentials. Eating, drinking, and running. I avoided music for the first 8 hours because I wanted to be open to everything around me, and because when the monotony became too much, I would need music. The thought of tunes became something to look forward to. The snow-capped mountain that marked the forward progress in my mind. Researchers speculate that music suppresses pain by, basically, focusing the brain on something else. Tunes. In one study, researchers found that listening to music created the same pain-easing results of taking a tablet of extra-strength Tylenol. An ultra-runner needs a finish line to stay sane, but if it obsesses him, he's doomed. I avoided thinking of the hours ahead. I avoided thinking of Shingo. When memories of my mother coursed through me, I used them to press me on. I wanted to lose myself, and by doing so, to discover new limits and to go beyond them. I wanted to pry myself open, going beyond the body and beyond the mind. Shingo stayed 2 laps in the lead, and even when shadows lengthened and beers and wines replaced the small cups of espresso at the street-side tables, I stayed with my pace. Revelers shouted and cheered all through the night. The rhythm continued until it wasn't even a rhythm. It was just being. It was everything and nothing. The great Yannis Kouros, who holds the world record of 180 miles at 24 hours on the road, has spoken and written of looking down on himself as he ran. I didn't leave my body, but I saw my father in the woods and watched him mime God letting dirt slide through his fingers. There was my mother, laughing, ladling a plate of mashed potatoes with butter. There were blindingly orange carrots, tomatoes redder than fire trucks. There were mouthfuls of guacamole so rich that I started salivating. I heard Dave Terry open a bottle of beer, watched him lean back in his kitchen and tell me that not all pain is significant. There was Dusty, beckoning me to keep going, keep going. I saw the electric blue of Silvino and the majestic stride of Arnulfo, and I didn't wonder how they did it anymore. I understood their secret. We can all understand it. We can live as we were meant to live, simply, joyously, of and on the earth. We can live with all our effort and with pure happiness. I ran for 8 hours before I listened to music. The piercing clarity had left me by then. Would it return? I put on my iPod then, but I didn't know what songs were playing. I ate noodle soup as I ran, and as much as I loved food, as much as eating brought me unmitigated joy, there were times when I couldn't taste it. I had never been so lonely. On the edge of the course, away from the revelers, there was only the sound of the river massaging the rocks, the wind combing the leaves of the trees, and the birds about to welcome a new day. 9 hours. 10 hours. Our past makes us, and we can't help but plan for the future. Some days I feel my mother's warm, strong hands on mine. Some days I envision the time I'll slow down, even stop and rest. 14 hours. 15. 16. 17 hours. The next month, I would deliver speeches, attend conferences, and accept accolades. In June of 2010, Jenny and I would drive to New Mexico and pull weeds on Kyle Skaggs' organic farm, then on to Boulder, Colorado. Shortly thereafter, Dusty would show up, and we would eat together and train together and repair our friendship. In September, I would visit U.S. military troops in Kuwait and run there, and tell soldiers about running, and listen to their stories about war. But on the snaking French course, the future didn't matter. The past was gone. There was only the trail. Only movement. There was only now. And now was enough. It was more than enough. It was everything. I ran. I ran and I ran. Dawn would come. It had to. The race would end. I would finish. I knew all that. But what should have been self-evident truths felt like prayers. 17 hours. Would clarity ever return? Wise Buddhist teachers advise pilgrims to chop wood and carry water until they encounter blinding, transformational epiphany. After that moment of electric bliss, the teachers say, chop more wood and carry more water. Running had brought me peace and clarity, and I kept running. Then the serenity was gone, and there was only the sad, sighing wind. I kept running. I knew my feet were moving, but I couldn't feel them. I thought of the Taoism I had studied, one of the many teachings that had nothing and everything to do with running. Specifically, I wondered if I was at that moment practicing Wu Wei or doing without doing. I kept running. I thought of Jenny and Dusty and my family and Hippie Dan and Ian and Dean Potter and all the people I had met through running. I climbed the mountains of Colorado and slogged through the valleys of California and jogged through the markets of Japan and the vineyards of Greece. And I saw all the people and places running had given me. I thought of pain, too. I thought of my recent yoga sessions, when my teacher, Big Bill, saw me struggling and said, this is what you came for. 18 hours. This is what you came for. I repeated it like a mantra. 19 hours. More soup. Another cliff shot. More bananas and big gulps of water. This is what you came for. As I said it, I realized that it sounded a lot like, sometimes you just do things. At the end of 19 hours, I saw Team USA coach Mike Spindler yelling times and lap counts for the American record. If I kept up my pace, I had a shot. 20 hours. 21 hours. 22 hours. 23 hours. The announcer called out my mileage. Other runners glanced over their shoulders as I approached and moved aside. A few French runners shouted, Allez, Scott! Allez, USA! I hit 162 miles with a half hour left, and a Team USA coach handed me an American flag. I held it proudly overhead for the last 5 laps, the last 30 minutes. At 10 a.m., on Friday, I finished, 1.5 miles ahead of Yvonne Cudin, who set a new Italian record, and 4 miles behind Shingo Inoue, who set a new Japanese record by only 300 meters. I had run 165.7 miles, an American record. No other North American had run farther in 24 hours. I had done what I had set out to do. It was time to rest. Then I would eat, and then run again. They are simple activities, common as grass, and they're sacred. Pilgrims seeking bliss carry water and chop wood, and they're simple things, too. But if they're approached with mindfulness and care, with attention to the present and humility, they can provide a portal to transcendence. They can illuminate the path leading to something larger than ourselves. It's easy to get wrapped up in deadlines and debt, victory and loss. Friends squabble, loved ones leave, people suffer. A 100-mile race, or a 5K, or a run around the block won't cure pain. A plate filled with guacamole and dinosaur kale will not deliver anyone from sorrow. But you can be transformed. Not overnight, but over time. Life is not a race. Neither is an ultramarathon, not really, even though it looks like one. There is no finish line. We strive toward a goal, and whether we achieve it or not is important, but it's not what's most important. What matters is how we move toward that goal. What's crucial is the step we're taking now, the step you're taking now. Everyone follows a different path. Eating well and running free helped me find mine. It can help you find yours. You never know where that path might take you. Rice balls, onigiri. I first saw these seaweed-wrapped rice packets when I asked a Japanese runner to show me what was in his race pack. I'm grateful I did, because white rice is a great food for cooling your body, especially in hot climates like Death Valley. It's packed with carbohydrates, it's not too sweet, and it's soft and easy to digest. A great source of electrolytes and salt, via the seaweed. Rice balls have always been a portable pick-me-up in Japan. These days, you can even find them at convenience stores in Asia. For a soy-free variation, substitute pickled ginger or omiboshi paste for the miso. You will need 2 cups sushi rice, 4 cups water, 2 teaspoons miso, 3 to 4 sheets nori seaweed. Cook the rice in the water on the stovetop or using a rice cooker. Set aside to cool. Fill a small bowl with water and wet both hands so the rice does not stick. Using your hands, form 1/4 cup rice into a triangle. Spread 1/4 teaspoon miso evenly on one side of the triangle. Cover with another 1/4 cup rice. Shape into one triangle, making sure the miso is covered with rice. Fold the nori sheets in half, and then tear them apart. Using half of one sheet, wrap the rice triangle in nori, making sure to completely cover the rice. Repeat using the remaining rice, miso, and nori. Makes 8 onigiri. Minnesota mashed potatoes. As a child, I had a glass of milk with every meal and could pile mashed potatoes higher than anyone in my family. I still love the dish, but now I use homemade rice milk, which is just as creamy and rich as the stuff from cows, much less expensive, and doesn't produce any plastic container waste. There's no better comfort food. You will need 5 to 6 medium red or yellow potatoes, 1 cup rice milk, recipe included later, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1/2 teaspoon sea salt, 1/2 teaspoon crushed black pepper, paprika, optional. Wash the potatoes, peel or leave the skins on as you prefer. Place in a pot and add enough water to completely cover 1 inch above the potatoes. Bring to a boil, covered, over high heat. Lower the heat and simmer for 20 to 25 minutes. Check the potatoes with a fork. If the fork goes into the potatoes easily, they are ready. Remove from the heat and drain. Mash the potatoes with a potato masher or hand mixer. Add the remaining ingredients and continue to mash until a smooth, fluffy consistency is reached. Season with a dash or two more salt and pepper and paprika if desired. Makes 4 to 6 servings. Rice milk. You will need 1 cup cooked brown or white rice, 4 cups water, 1/8 teaspoon sea salt, 1 tablespoon sunflower oil, optional. Combine the rice, water, and salt in a blender. If you want a creamier milk, add the oil. Blend on high for 1 to 2 minutes until smooth. Pour into a container, cover, and refrigerate. Rice milk will keep for 4 to 5 days. Makes 5 cups. Lentil mushroom burgers. For any reluctant vegan who worries that nothing will ever replace the taste or texture of a juicy beef patty, consider the lentil burger. It might not matter so much that lentils are an excellent source of protein, that they are one of the fastest cooking legumes, or that they are consumed in large quantities all over Europe, Asia, and Africa, even Idaho. What will impress you is how tender, juicy, and meaty they taste. I grew up grilling over campfires, and I know burgers. These are as delicious as they come. Sometimes, I'll even take a few patties with me on long training runs and races. You will need 1 cup dried green lentils, 2 1/4 cups cooked, 2 1/4 cups water, 1 teaspoon dried parsley, 1/4 teaspoon black pepper, 3 garlic cloves, minced, 1 1/4 cups finely chopped onion, 3/4 cup finely chopped walnuts, 2 cups fine breadcrumbs, 1/2 cup ground flaxseed, 3 cups finely chopped mushrooms, 1 1/2 cups destemmed, fine chopped kale, spinach, or winter greens, 2 tablespoons coconut oil or olive oil, 3 tablespoons balsamic vinegar, 2 tablespoons Dijon mustard, 2 tablespoons nutritional yeast, 1 teaspoon sea salt, 1/2 teaspoon black pepper, 1/2 teaspoon paprika. In a small pot, bring the lentils, water, parsley, 1 garlic clove, and 1/4 cup of the onion to a boil. Reduce heat and simmer, partially covered, for 35 to 40 minutes until the water is absorbed and the lentils are soft. When the lentils are cooking, combine the walnuts, breadcrumbs, and flaxseed in a bowl. Add the nutritional yeast, salt, and pepper, and paprika, and mix well. Sauté the remaining onion, remaining garlic, the mushroom, and greens in the oil for 8 to 10 minutes, then set aside. Remove the lentils from the heat, add the vinegar and mustard, and mash with a potato masher or wooden spoon to a thick paste. In a large mixing bowl, combine the lentils, sautéed veggies, and breadcrumb mixtures and mix well. Cool in the refrigerator for 15 to 30 minutes or more. Using your hands, form burger patties to your desired size and place on waxed paper. Lightly fry in a seasoned skillet, broil, or grill until lightly browned and crisp, 3 to 5 minutes on each side. Extra uncooked patties can be frozen on waxed paper, in plastic bags, or wrapped individually in aluminum foil, making for a quick dinner or wholesome burger for the next barbecue. Mix a dozen 4-inch diameter burgers. Note: to make the breadcrumbs, you'll need about 1/2 loaf of day-old bread. I use Ezekiel 4:9. Slice the bread, then tear or cut into 2 to 3-inch pieces and chop in a food processor for 1 to 2 minutes until a fine crumb results. The walnuts can also be chopped in the food processor with the bread. Apple cinnamon granola. The secrets to this recipe are in the soaked oat groats and the hemp milk. Soaking the oat groats, the whole grain form of oats, promotes the release of enzymes that aid digestion. Hemp seeds are high in omega-3 fatty acids, and hemp milk creates a creamy, light accompaniment to the crunchy granola. It's perfect for before or after a morning workout or race. You will need 1 to 2 teaspoons coconut oil, 4 cups raw oat groats soaked in water for 6 to 8 hours or overnight, then drained, 1 apple, cored and sliced, 1/2 cup dried coconut flakes, 2 teaspoons ground cinnamon, 2 tablespoons maple syrup or 1 tablespoon agave nectar, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1/2 teaspoon sea salt, 1/2 cup raw almonds chopped, 1/2 cup pumpkin seeds chopped, 2/3 cup raisins. Preheat the oven to 250 degrees Fahrenheit. Grease 2 baking sheets with the oil. Process the oats, apple, coconut, cinnamon, sweetener, vanilla, and salt into a food processor for 30 seconds. Scrape sides, process for another 30 seconds, and repeat one more time. Transfer the mixture to a large mixing bowl and combine with the almonds, pumpkin seeds, and raisins. Mix thoroughly with a spoon. Spread the mixture in a thin layer on the prepared baking sheets. Bake for 2 to 4 hours, turning the granola over a few times with a spatula until dried and crisp. You can set the oven temperature higher and reduce the baking time, but be sure to check frequently to avoid burning. Cool and stir in the raisins. Serve with non-dairy milk and sliced banana or fresh berries. Keeps for 3 to 4 weeks in an airtight container. Makes 8 to 10 servings. Hemp milk. You will need 1/4 cup raw shelled hemp seeds, 4 cups water, 1/4 cup teaspoon sea salt, 1 to 2 teaspoons agave nectar or maple syrup, optional. Place the hemp seeds, water, and salt into a blender and blend on high for 1 to 2 minutes until smooth and milky. For sweeter milk, add agave nectar or maple syrup to taste. Hemp milk keeps for 4 to 5 days in the refrigerator. Makes 5 cups. Long run pizza bread. When I was an omnivorous teenager in northern Minnesota, the idea of pizza without cheese would have sounded like winter without snow. Interesting, but impossible. As a plant-eating adult, finding a tasty vegan pizza is about as easy